Welcome to New Narrative Southeast Asia Dispatches. I'm your host, Bonibel Ramatan, Editorial Manager for New Narrative. New Narrative is a movement to democratize democracy in Southeast Asia, and this podcast is one of the ways we attempt to do just that. Imagine a situation where there was an election, all good and valid, and we have some winners of that election. But then the winners, even after counting all the votes and there had been no fraud or rigging in any way, were not able to secure a clear position as a ruling government. I think we'd all agree that it's hardly a democracy at that point. Unfortunately, that is what is currently happening in Thailand. It's been months since the May 14th elections this year, and at the time of the recording, August 11th, Thailand still has no new government. Thailand's political situation has been rather tumultuous for a while. What began as pro-democracy marches by students in February of 2020 expanded into endless protests against the pro-military administration and has become the first time in modern Thai history that the monarchy has been discussed openly in a critical manner, despite the fact that doing so is a punishable violation. The movement is calling for three major reforms in Thailand's existing administration. 1. Dissolve the parliament. 2. Rewrite the military-backed constitution. And 3. Stop intimidating and arbitrarily arresting critics. At the height of the situation, the movement also founded protection mechanisms for human rights defenders and activists, which aim to provide digital security support and assistance to activists in need through the helpline service.
So my name is Darika Bamlung Chok. For now that I'm working with two organizations. One is we call Thai Citizen Network that based in Thailand. We focus on the internet freedoms in the country, and also I'm working on the digital security and the protection with the security matter, the organization based in Malaysia that we focus on the security and protection in Southeast Asia.
That is Darika Bamlung Chok, digital security trainer and digital rights advocate at Thai Netizen Network and Security Matters. She's the leader of digital rights and digital safety programs in Thailand. She's also an experienced campaigner and focuses on the use of technology in human rights defense under authoritarian regimes. In this episode, we'll be talking about what's happening in Thailand after the elections and the importance of digital security support during protests. So let's just jump right away to the questions. We're here to talk about the Thai protests. So can we maybe just briefly explain to the listeners about the... Because it's been going on for a few years, right? It's since 2020, 2021. What was actually the background, what the trigger? What are the demands that of the people? Why did it happen? And in several ways, nonetheless.
Okay, sure. I mean, I would say that this is the most critical moment, and also like it's quite interesting time to talk about what happened in Thailand, especially after the last election in May this year. So I think like as we are recording the podcast today is like a second week of August, and it's like has been 3 months since the election in May, but Thailand still doesn't have a new government yet. So every day like the Progressive Move Forward Party, who is a winner in the election, but they has been excluded from the coalition to hope to form the new government in Thailand. So I think this is could be seen as a highlighting the problematic nature of the Thai politics, like since we have the military coup in 2014. And then if I have to summarize what is happening in Thailand and how it's like influenced from my observation. So I would like to mention like 5 factors that are shaping the current political landscape in Thailand. And is it interestingly that all these 5 factors like start with letter M's. So for the first M in Thailand would be monarchy that we have to mention here. As some of you know that talking about the king and the royal family was a taboo for the public discussion in Thailand. I mean, the topic was considered untouchable topic because we still have the Article 112 or the Lese Majesty law that it makes illegal to criticize the royal family in Thailand. And the Article 112 has been politicized and used to as a tool during the political crisis. So one of the Article 112 cases involved with like a woman, I mean, who was sentenced like 43 years in the prison because of her sharing the social media post criticizing the monarchy. This is one of the example. But then if we look at the number according to the Thai Human Rights for Lawyers or the THR that we mentioned organization, I mean the number between the November 2020 until like for example like the first week of August this year, at least 255 people has been charged under the Article 112. And many of them are the young activists who took part in the protest that you mentioned is started in the 2020. And then when we discuss about the protest in Thailand, I would like to go back to the protest in like a 2020 that led by young activists and the student who took the street protest after dissolution of the Future Forward Party. So this political action triggered the significant protests across the country. And one of the demands by the protester was to reform the monarchy in Thailand, particular 112 that I mentioned for the Lex Majestas law. And I consider that this is the first time, as you mentioned, in the modern Thai political history that the Thai people openly discussed the status of the royal family in the public. So that is the first aim factor that I mentioned here. So the second aim, that is military. So Thailand has experienced more military coups than any other country in the world. So if we are to capture the current political crisis, so we need to start with military coup in 2014, led by General Prayut Chan-o-cha. And later in 2017, that the junta proposed a new constitution that is designed to ensure military control of the Thai politics, even though under the civilian government. So that's why I mentioned about the current constitution. The prime minister need to be selected by a combined vote of the two houses of the parliament, which is like unelected senator of the 250 members. This is like, I mean, handpicked by the junta. And then the House of Representatives of 500 elected members. And then after the constitution took effect, the military junta announced the election back then in 2019, so that the military power can hand over that power to a civilian government. But then again, that it led by the same person as the prime minister, like I mentioned, General Prayut Chan-o-cha, who was a coup maker in the 2014. So following this, like the most progressive political party during the election in 2019, Future Forward Party, I mean, they has been popular among young voters. And then they was disbanded by the Constitutional Court. This is the main reason why the young people took part in the series of the state protests that you mentioned during the 2020 until like a 2021. So then I want to highlight the last election in the 14th of May this year was still conducted under the Constitution, which is remain a legacy of the military coup makers. So let's move to another aim, which is monopoly in Thailand. So the Thai economy is dominated by the monopolies, and the country is facing a painful economic inequality. We can look at some of the big industry in Thailand, such as like duty-free business, whiskey, alcohol, beer business, as an example of the monopolistic establishment that dominate the business and the market in the country in the unfair way. So to understand how complicated the Thai politics, that we need to see the relationship between the three big M actors that I mentioned, monarchy, military, and monopoly in Thailand. These are the long-standing issue that is quite critical topic that shaping the country political landscape. So now that I would like to draw the attention to my hopeful aim, which is like movement and mobilization in Thailand. And as Bonnie mentioned in introduction, that the youth lead protest in the 2020 that marked a new wave of the student protests in Thailand. As someone working in the human rights and activism, it was excited to see how social movements started with the young people, students taking part the lead in the democratization. Their political awakening that sparked a significant mobilization across the countries. So to capture my last 5 years of working that focus on the digital security training for human rights defenders, especially during the protests. And then when we talk about the protests in our context in Thailand or even though in Southeast Asia, and as you know, like building a pro-democracy movement, protesting under authoritarian regimes, meaning that our journey is like a lucky, you know, it's not easy journey with many challenges. After the big protest in like 2020 and crackdown, I mean, some of the Thai people activists might think that the street protest cannot change the political system, as we still discuss about the crisis in the parliament, in the political landscape. It seemed that not working under the authoritarian regime when we talk about like doing, even though the big protests are happening in Thailand. But I think for me to see the protests and public mobilization significantly contribute and shape the Thailand political landscape and then the public discourse. I see the protest as one of the platforms and the space for political socialization and the put forward with the public discussion on the critical topic, critical problem in the country. And then they did, as we see Thailand as an example. So that's why this is like, when we talk about the protest mobilization, we look at the collective experience, like both online and offline, that people can express their concern, their angers, their feeling what is happening in the country. So let's go back to Thailand after this solution of the Future Forward Party in the 2020. It's become the significant factor to spark pro-democracy protests and mobilize 10,000 people of Thai people, particularly for the young people, to demand to have a new constitution, to have a new election back then, and a reform of the monarchy. And then we had the election this year on the 14th of May, which like most progressive political party become a winner. And then they have the legitimacy to form the new government. But then again, for the what is happening for now, the new coalition is moving on without Move Forward Party, which is the winning party. And then the winning party is might become the opposition party. This has raised a lot of concern for the Thai people and the voter. And then one of the hashtags after the election is like the hashtag why we have an election. So that's why when we have the election and the winning party could not form the government, and that's why it's raised a lot of concern and a lot of the question what happening after the election. And now we talk about the Twitter and hashtag. I would like to move to my last M factor, which is media. This is like include the social media platforms. We have a significant influence on the current political landscape. If we discuss the protest during 2020, I would say that Twitter is could be one of the factors are linked to the public mobilization and the state protests, especially by young people. And but then if we look at the political change during the election this year, we have to mention TikTok as a key platform that is help and support political campaigns during the election, that is to make a new and young political party like a Move Forward Party, that they become the winner and then like get the vote from the Thai citizen across the country, especially not just only young voter as before, but they can get the support from the people across diverse generation across the country. That's why we can see from the last the election result how the, you know, one of the social media platforms could have the impact on the political landscape in the country as well. So it's not just only Thailand when we talk about the mobilization and then social media rise as a factor for the democratization. We can see like other countries in the world as well. But I have to say that the social media is one of the factors that have the impact on the movement and mobilization. Although we have other factors that contribute to the development of the youth movement. And as we know that living under the authoritarian regimes, repressive regimes, movement and media is always become the target of the crackdown, harassment by the authorities. So that's why it's a high risk of the speaking up to uphold the freedom of expression in the countries. So this is like what's happening in Thailand, if I have to capture really like briefly up until today.
Thank you, Derica. That was a very comprehensive overview of what's going on in Thailand. And I believe the listeners would really appreciate that. And I really like personally your point of view about, you know, people commenting that, you know, why protest, right? Why, even an election, you know, is the result is very questionable since the winning party can't even form the government. So, and street protests, like, it can't change political systems. So why actually have them? And your response was actually to, you know, it nonetheless pushes forward the public discussions and critical problems in the country. They're being discussed a lot more openly right now. So I think that's a really important perspective to have when faced with these kinds of challenges. But when we look at the initial demands of our of the protests and back in 2020 versus you know, what's going on today, in terms of progress, where would you say that, you know, but where are we now?
Well, yeah, when you ask me where are we now, I think it's a hard question. I wish I could know what is going to be after this in Thailand, because the situation is changing like every day since the election on the 14th of May. And you know what, like every day when I wake up in the morning, I was so scared of what bad news that I will hear again. And then I think this kind of the situation is quite stressful and people feel like upset, angry to see the prime minister candidate from the winning party, his name is Tim Pita Lim Tse Lun Lat, not be able to become the prime minister, even though he's like a legitimate leader from the election result. As I mentioned before, like how authorities has been using a number of tactics and the way to maintain their power. Day by day, we have seen the new political tactics mixed with the old tactic that we are familiar in the past. And then they use, like before, they use a military coup in 2014. Then we kind of see like judicial coup with the constitutional court that was highly politicized to disband the opposition party. And now we are seeing like a deadlock in the parliament under the current constitution in Thailand, which is drafted by the junta to block the pro-democracy party from taking the lead position in the new government. But however, I would say that the election result with the Move Forward Party as the winner is a turning point in the Thai politics. We could see and hear what Thai people want, and then what the Thai people vote for the most progressive political party that aim to tackle the problem of the big M factor that I mentioned before, like monopoly, military, and monarchy reforms. And then this political party become the winner in the election. So what we know from the surprisingly outcome of the election, this is like the Thai people are hoping for change, And then when we say about change in these situations, it means that it's a structural change. It's not just only the economic incentives or the populist campaign during the election that it worked before, but it didn't work for now. But the people want to see a reform of the political structure in the country. That is happening after the election result. But then the conservative power want to block the winning political party and then deny the people hope for change. So that's why I mentioned about the deadlock in the parliament under the current constitution. So I would say that this is a critical juncture or the transition of the Thai politics. I mean, if I were the international audience observing the political situation in Thailand, I would say that this is a very interesting moment with the implication for democracy. It's not just in Thailand, but in our Southeast Asia regions. So I want to emphasize that when it comes to the transition or the critical times. So that's why we need the attention to support democracy movement and advocacy across the Southeast Asia countries. We look at the election in Cambodia, the situation in Myanmar after the coup, the ruling party in the Philippines, and then we still keep eye on the upcoming the election in Indonesia. And at some part that we saw some of the same and common tactics that the governments are using it. So it seemed like they learn from each other to control like how to maintain their power. But then if you ask me as I'm the Thai citizen living in the country, I think I would say that I'm really emotional with like mixed feelings. I mean, see the situation, especially after the election. Like, of course, the mixed feeling I mentioned is like, I mean, feeling very stressed, angry, I guess, disappointed, and sometimes even sad. For now, at least for three months after the elections. But I think, but however, I still have some hope for radical change that will come. And I believe that if you ask me like where we are now, I think I believe that for those people who want to, you know, stop time or denying the nation, like the nature of the change in the society, it look like Mission Impossible. This is like not the Tom Cruise movie, and you know, but it's like reality, especially like take the Thailand as an example. It's almost 10 years since the military took power in the 2014, and the willingness of the people to see change in the country, and then they feeling to see change that is going up and is stronger day by day. But then again, if we ask for the civil society in Southeast Asia or in Thailand, and that's why we need to have the collective effort. That's why it's very important time for like, you know, solidarity, advocacy for the international community at this moment.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. It's a very important point, right? When you bring up that people like, you know, authorities, like governments in Southeast Asia, they just learn from one another about how they can get a better stronghold, get a better grasp of the people and just control the movement, just really repress society in a lot of different ways. But at the same time, a lot of it is the same, right? And it's very, you know, it's very valid when you mention that, you know, of course you'd be very emotional, you'd be stressed, angry and disappointed, because that's how these kinds of politics affects us. And just making it like really visible out there and making it having the awareness that this is kind of like a regional problem. It's a very deep-rooted national problem, but it's also a regional problem, right? But that's precisely why we need to build these solidarities. We need to build these kinds of advocacy efforts, because we can't deny change, right? Everyone's, you know, people will move. People can't, you just can't kill off everyone, right? Because like people people need change, and as you mentioned, the willingness of people to see change has been growing. But to get more concrete, though, what are the ongoing advocacy efforts that are currently happening?
Yeah, I mean, for the ongoing efforts and advocacy, both by civil society and the activists, especially after the election in Thailand, and then they are campaigning for respect my word. So like the hashtag, even though like, you know, the put on the t-shirts, put on like the profile picture on the social media, is like, respect my word. So that is kind of like what is people try to mention, hey, this is like the election result, and then should respect for the water in the country as well. And then for the international media coverage is focusing on like how the challenges and how the struggle of the new Thai governments after the election that even now we still had no idea who will be the prime minister. But however, if we ask for international support or advocacy, I mean, from my observation, we haven't received much international support or pressure at the moment. And then for my part, I mean, for my focus that working on the security support and protection, I mean, basically that we use like three strategies. For the first one, we still aim to build the local capacity. For example, like to train the new digital security trainers who can support for the local community is still needed. And the second strategy that is to prepare for the instant response or the rapid response that we call like help desk service. So especially like what we have learned from the big protest in the 3 years ago, and now we have to be prepared and then like have to, you know, do some a lot of preparation if the rapid response or like the big protest will happen. What is kind of the security working group that we have to aware of that? And then the last strategy is just like, I think the international advocacy. I mean, for my focus, it's about like internet freedoms, digital security and digital rights in Thailand. And then how we can connect with the local and the network in the country to the regional collaboration, especially in Southeast Asia. When we talk about like digital rights and digital security, although like we know it's a high demand, but also this kind of the working area is still new, especially in the Southeast Asia. That's why I think this is like effort that we still want to build the Southeast Asia network when it comes to the digital right and security support.
I see. So you reach out, you work with these local networks, you work with these grassroots organizations. How do you do it? Like, I mean, just in terms of training the digital security trainers, do they reach out to you, or do you already have, is there already like this network in Thailand? Because as you mentioned, things are changing every day, and you know, the movements are very volatile in a sense. So how do you keep things maintained and stable, and how do you train people regularly and reach out to the right people? Yeah, maybe can you share us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. And then also, I think I would like to start to explain a little bit about my team, and especially for the team based in Malaysia that we call Security Matter, because our team is still new and like a small team of the people. So like the project start in Malaysia and then like expanded to Thailand. So when we set up like the team, so our objective is to, you know, to address the gap between the digital and physical security, especially when it comes to capacity buildings and then how we can build like security system for the human rights defenders. And I think the ultimate challenge at the beginning when we try to set up our project is like to fill a gap and the challenges between the local and then international support to provide a just-in-time the security support in Southeast Asia countries. And one of like the key focus is to localize the material, you know, the resources, and also what is the need when it comes to the material development in the local need. And then we prioritize the country in Southeast Asia that still need to build the local capacity. That's why I take Thailand as an example. And while we want to build the regional collaboration, but for that, we need to build a strong local capacity and network of the people in the country who can connect to the regional and international work. This is what we believe in. So at the beginning of the first step, so our focus is to understand the local context and the need as much as we can. So that's why we start to do a mapping, threat analysis and the country research. So in my case, that I conduct the country research in Thailand, and my colleague did the research in Malaysia to get the comprehensive understandings. What are the challenges? What are the threats? What are the gap and the need from the society in the country? So so our main approach to find a way of building the local capacity and then a network of first responders in the countries. And that's why after that, we aim to set up the local help desks. So after we finish the country research and the mappings, so that's why it helped to identify who are they, the key local partners, who are they, like the target group that it needs to build the security support, and who will be the potential first responder that we can build for the long term for their communities. So, and then when we look at the context in Thailand, before we started our local help desk, and then we had a series of the protests across the country that we mentioned before. And we have to say that during that time, we didn't have a proper system to provide security support. And then when the protest is like happens almost like every day or even like every weekend across the country, and the high demand for the security support, the security training, we didn't have the well preparation for the, you know, for the system that we can support, like the amount of the people who can reach out to us. And then when we talk about the security, it's involved about the trust building. So normally that the people will reach out to the people that they trust. And that's why it's the main challenge. And then we have to aware when we have to do the security support. And then when we mention about the training, and this is one of the key activity that we try to do it. And then if we look at the protests happen almost every week, sometimes every day across the country. And then like it's become a challenge to ask the activists, you know, to join the training for 3 days, 2 days. It's too long. It's too long for them. They don't have time to just join the training. I mean, digital security training for even for 2 days. And that's why what we have learned that we have to adjust the training session that is made like properly maximum only half day, or even sometimes it's maximum for 2 hours just before the actual protest, to include what is a risk assessment, what is a mitigation planning. So what we found out when we talk about the digital security separately from their activism, I think it's very difficult for them to integrate the security planning to their activism and mobilization. But then if we want to introduce the security planning, we should like integrate with their activism or even their mobilization, and then like to build what is a parallel thinking when they have to do the activities and at the same time for the security, that part of the activity planning. So I think that is kind of the methodology that we try to build security support. And also what we try to do is like identify the target activist network who can be the potential of the first responders, which means that they already have their community that they work with. And then when the incident is happen, so the focal point could like, you know, coordinate with our team. So that is why that methodology that we start doing at the beginning.
Okay, wow. Yeah, that's really comprehensive. But also, I like how you iterate the various trainings based on the needs of the protesters. And like 2 hours, I wouldn't have thought of that, like 2 hours and then just right before the protest is going on and stuff like that. So but yeah, just moving back a little bit, and I'm sure the listeners would also appreciate a bit of a more 101 here in terms of like digital security, because when we talk about physical security in protests, I'm sure a lot of people can think about like, you know, tear gas and responding to the officers there that might be assaulting you and stuff like that. But digital security isn't like super obvious from the get-go. So maybe just tell us a little bit about what is it about, really? What are the cyber threats? What is the basic self-defense, basic digital security steps that we need to take?
Yeah. As we know that for the digital technology has been developed very fast. But at the same time, for the cyber threat, digital threats, it also evolving very fast at the same time. So I think if you look at the Thailand as an example, and sometimes like I identify four type of the, we call like digital authoritarianisms to identify what is kind of the key focus when we talk about the digital landscape, especially targeting for the human rights defenders. As far as we know that for the first tactic, that authority is also using that is a judicial harassment. So for target the activists to arrest the people or the online user. I think that is quite common tactic that happening in many Southeast Asia country. This is not the technical tactic, right? When we talk about the cyber threat. But then when we talk about the working with the activists, I think the legal harassment is become the common tactic that they are facing by the authorities. And then the second tactics or the area is like the internet shutdown and the online censorship. So I think Thailand, when it comes to the internet shutdown, is not obvious, it's not critical situation compared to Myanmar, as far as we know, for the internet shutdown. Or even like censorship in Vietnam. I think for Thailand, it that not kind of the serious as far as we compare to other Southeast Asia country when it comes to the internet shutdown or the censorship. But for the censorship, it still have like, you know, like traditional blocking website is still happening. But I think what I, from my observations, especially after the military coup in Thailand, the way that the authority also, you know, develop their strategy as well. Before, they want to block the website, you know, just like to block the website or the content itself. And then they realize that it's not effective during this the internet landscapes. Rather than to block or delete the content that they don't want to put on the internet. So they move to the third tactic that I would like to mention, which is like information operation. Or like, you know, as we know about like the social manipulation, disinformation campaign, especially for target the activists or the protester during the protesting. So I think for this kind of the tactic, I found out it's really challenging when it comes to the digital security. When it comes to like, you know, state information operation is happening in many like Southeast Asia country, in the Philippines, in Thailand, in Myanmar, in Vietnam. And it's not just about like technical support, but then if it's like online harassment targeting, for example, like the women human rights defenders, and if it's related to the sexual harassment, it's online. It's not just only like technical support that we have to do that, but we have to do like integrate with the holistic security support, which means like the mental and the psychosocial support that is could be part when we have to talk with about like the online harassment, especially for the women and the diverse gender group in the countries. So I think that the information campaign targeting the activists and the disinformation is critical, and then, you know, getting challenged and difficult for the security landscape in the country. And the last section that I would like to mention is about the surveillance. This is one of the most difficult topics, because like when we talk about the surveillance, which means like how we can detect that the, you know, the surveillance tactics, because it's always like underground and then the secret, and then there's no one, you know, take up that, okay, who is like did the digital surveillance. So I think that the surveillance tactics, by using a lot of the, you know, the technologies, even though it's not like only high-tech technology, they can use like CCTV, they can use like GPS tracking devices, until we found out they used the advanced the spyware Pegasus is very, like we found out in Thailand. So that is kind of like the surveillance technique that we found out targeting especially for the activists in the countries. But then when you ask is like how especially for the activists or the human rights defenders can protect ourselves. And then when we talk about security, which means that we don't have the perfect solution. I mean, the challenge when we talk about, especially for the digital security, we cannot provide only checklists or absolute answer, and then like just give to the activists and say, hey, if you follow this, you will be completely safe. So I think it's not working in that way. And at the same time, when we talk about digital security, it's not about the tools or application or, you know, technical platform that they are using at. What I want to prioritize is like when we talk about the security, which means that how much of our understanding the threat, how much the risk assessments or how much the local analysis that we can identify what are the threat, what are the risks, and what the strategy that we have to mitigate it. So I think the concept of the security, I would like to prioritize about the risk assessments. And some of the approach for the security trainer, we know that about the threat modeling. So we try to like understand what is like the threat model that we should to aware of that, in the sense that we can come up with a mitigation, with a strategy to mitigate those kinds of risks. So I think I might give some of the simple, a list of the questions for the audience when we try to do like risk assessment, and then we can start with the simple questions to understand the level of the risk that you are at it. I think maybe for the first question, we can start to ask ourselves who you are and what you are doing it. When I mention like who you are, for example, like if you are the journalist, what are you doing it? For example, like I'm a journalist, I'm working on the article about the corruption. So that's why the next question is like, what kinds of information it involves. So for the first question is like start like who you are. For example, like if you are a journalist, you are the human rights defenders who work in your community. So what kinds of the activity that you are doing it? And then what kinds of the information that is might be involved? So this is the first question. So, and then we can move to the second question. What can go wrong? What kinds of scenario that if you are doing this kinds of activity, what kinds of the personal information in a way that it can export it? Or it could be, you know, violate the personal information. It could be your personal information, or it could be the information of the people that you are working with. And then who are the target that is my target for your information or your, I mean, your group of the people that you go with. So the second question is like, what is the scenario that it could go wrong? You know, if it's kind of the bad scenario it happened, what kind of scenario it should be? So when we have this scenario, we can move to the next question is like, what are you going to do about that? If this scenario that happened, what are the mitigation? What are the changes? What are the behavior change, technology support? What kinds of the mitigation that you can do about that if that scenario, bad scenario that happened? So that's why when we're thinking about the scenario, this question is try to help you identify what are the changes that you have to deal with the security scenario. So the last question is like, after we have the scenario, we have the mitigation, and then we have to like, maybe we can ask ourselves like, did you do the good job? You know, this part is like evaluation of the security planning that we are discuss about. So because as we know for the security, it's like evolving every time. The question that we asked like properly last year, maybe for this time we have to start to like ask ourselves again whether that we have to have a new strategy to do with it. So I think that's why I think the last thing if I would like to mention is about like for the first thing that we accept the risk is already exists. We know that, okay, we identify the risk, this is already exists. And then we try to understand the risk and the situation that we are facing it. And after that, we know that if it comes up a lot of the security concern, it might, you know, infinity risk or even a long concerns. But we have the limited resources. You have only like two people in your group. You have only like, you know, small budget or the small team that it can't support, which means that we have to prioritize which risk that you have to deal with, which means the prioritization under your limited resources is very important. And the last thing that we have to thinking about the scenario according to the landscape that we are working on. So that's why the situation analysis for your context, that is very important to understand as much we can do to identify the good security planning. I think that is kind of the concept. I cannot provide, you know, only the technical solution, because what I perceive that when we talk about digital security, our first impression is might be about the technical or IT or encryption, which is a part of that. But as far as we know, what is the challenge is about our behaviors. So I think that is another thing when we talk about digital security, maybe like back to basic is about like how we can change our behavior in the sense that it can increase our safety, especially for the digital habit. So I would stop here.
Yeah, thank you. I keep using this word, but it is very comprehensive. And I love that approach for, you know, because, yeah, obviously a lot of people, when they talk about digital security, the first impression would be, okay, what are the technicalities, right? But approaching it in that manner makes a lot of sense and I think is very important. So my next question, I guess, is are people aware of that in Thailand in the context of the digital security support in the Thai protests themselves, in the movements and all of that? Are people already mostly aware, do you feel, about these issues? Are they still, you know, do they still need a lot of training? And basically, I guess, what can we improve in the situation?
Yeah, I think at least for if we start at the protest in 2020 up until now, I think I have seen in the development in terms of the digital support for their movement, for their network, especially for the activists on the ground. So I think that's why when we talk about the digital security and the mitigation, we try to mention this is the path of the movement building and activism. So that's why if we want to build like social movement, if we want to build like the activist movement, the security, it should be one of the important factor behind the scene of the movement buildings. So that's why when I have to like provide security training, especially for the frontliners, for the activists who, you know, really high profile, I would like to start to mention that when we talk about the security or the security pendings, I came here to talk to you. It doesn't mean that I will stop your activism because it's too risky, you know, because sometimes when we talk about the security, hey, you should not do 1, 2, 3 because that you will be safe. This is too risky. It doesn't make in that way. So the goal, the objective of the security planning, that it not stop your activism, but we want to prioritize that how we can mitigate the risk and then reduce the threat that you are facing it to protect your the community, the network. So that's why if the activists want to do very high risk activisms, which means that the security planning, it should be paralleled with their activism planning at the same time. So I think that's why what I have seen, at least for like 3 years after the protest, I have seen that a lot of the security awareness, especially for the young activists, it has been increasing. Because that's why I think when we talk about the security support, it's not just about the technical, but how we can build the security awareness and culture of the movement. How we can see that if we want to build the movement building, which means that the security culture and the awareness should be part of the movement building at the same time. But then along the way, as we know that it's a lot of challenges to provide the security, especially during the critical time in the country. And some of the people might perceive security support as the band-aid solution for the emergency situation, like ad hoc support. Like you got like the incident response, that's why you need the band-aid, you know, for the rapid response, which is true. I mean, like when we talk about the security incident, but then the importance of the security support, that how we can build the security system in the longer terms. It's not just only the ad hoc or the band-aid. Band-aid is just on the surface, but behind the scene, that how we can build a long-term capacity building with that movement, and then how we can sustain the security network inside the country. I think this is like a one of the objective that we try to do the security support, especially when we have to move with the activist movement. And then when we have like very high demand, you know, for the security trainings or for the digital support, and then when we are facing like understaffed, underfunded, for the people who have to do the security, especially in the countries. So that's why I think in terms of the need, we still need a lot of support for fundings to build in the sense that how we can build the local capacity group in the long term and sustain. I don't want to see like only the ad hoc support just for like, you know, high risk situation that happened in the country, because we want to like sustain the security system, that it should make sure that it will be in the long term. This is for the local support. And after that, how we can build the regional collaboration in the regions, especially in Southeast Asia. I think when we talk about the digital security in Southeast Asia, of course, it's not be the same when we talk in the US or the European countries, because the context is super like different. So that's why in the Southeast Asia, I hope to see the collaboration in the sense that how we can collaborate with the local network and then the community, and then we can build what is the local need and then the regional effort that it can support in the digital security, especially for the localizations of the materials or the challenge resources. I think that is still a gap in the Southeast Asia. And I think that is kind of the step that I try to see how it's like digital security. And then I believe that it should start in the local context, and then we can connect if we have the activist groups or the security people or the trainers, and then we can link to the Southeast Asia as a getting more support on that.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, it's about resilience, isn't it? It's about making the democracy movement, making the protests a lot more resilient via the digital security, but also via the awareness of how to approach digital security, and also about, again, as you mentioned, funding and building solidarity networks and all of these things, right? So I guess that leads to my last question. What do we do concretely as Southeast Asians to advocate for, you know, to advocate for the situation in Thailand, but also to strengthen these solidarity networks, these movements? Or if you have suggestions on where to, how we can start to, you know, building and raising awareness of the importance of like digital security and digital resilience. Yeah, feel free to tell us about that.
Yeah, I mentioned the word when you mentioned about the resilience. So which means that as we talk about the democratization in especially in Southeast Asia, it's long journeys, right? It's like a marathon. So it's not like the sprint runnings. So that's why the awareness and then the strategy of being resilient for the movement, I think is very important. But then again, when we unpack what kinds of the resilience or the skill or the need to build the resilient movement, it could be many things. It could be the security support is one of that. Advocacy is could be one of that. Network building is could be one of the factor of that. Because, and then look at the strategic campaigning advocacy in the longer term, it could be like one of the element when we talk about like being resilient. And then I would like to go back a little bit in terms of the situation in Thailand. As I mentioned, this is like critical moment for the Thai politics during the transition. When we talk about like transition, we still don't know where we are going, which kinds of direction. It's going to be better or even worse. So that's why when I mentioned about like the government in Southeast Asia always find a way to maintain their power and control like democratization process in the countries that are taking Thailand as the example and the case studies and how the authoritarian power try to keep, you know, the international community out of their countries. So that's why they allow us to have the protest and then they crack down on the protester by arresting the activists, but in Thailand with the minimum physical violation, but still limited the freedom of expression and assembly in the countries. And why the authority allows us to have the election, but then they didn't allow the winner party to be the prime minister. So I think that in the case of Thailand, it seems to be they are pretending to be a democratic on the surface. And then, but at the same time, the authorities, the government still care for the international community and then the economic developments. So that's why they don't want to perceive as the totally authoritarian state, regime. They don't want to be in that situation or status because it's very difficult for them to talk to the international communities or even for the economic developments. So that's why I'm saying that because the international pressure, international solidarity, international support is one of the critical factors. And then it could play the important role in terms of democratized session in the country at the moment. So that's why I want to highlight in terms of, I think the first thing, look at the Southeast Asia, we can have like how we can, I mentioned if the government in Southeast Asia, they can share their common strategy, right? They can use their common tactic. Maybe they learn from each other. But the question is like how the civil society in Southeast Asia do at the same time. I mean, the sharing resources, sharing that what is the strategic campaign that we can doing together. This is not just for Thailand, but like look at Thailand as a case study. And then when we took like Philippines like about the media freedoms, we took like case study in Myanmar or even in the Vietnam. So I think that we can mapping out, you know, the local challenges in the countries. And then, but at the same time, when it comes to the advocacy strategy as a regional effort, I think that we need to do that. And then also, if you ask me the concrete example, I think because as a local CSO in the country, we know that for the people in that country, they already struggle for their challenges, for their situation. But at the same time, it's a lot of effort that is too high risk to do inside the countries. So that's why I mentioned a lot in terms of the regional collaboration, in terms of the international solidarity. I think this part is could be the critical factor that I would like to highlight here. Especially like if we look at the development of democracies in Thailand for this time, that is could have the implication for other Southeast Asia countries. Because like, I mean, authoritarian power want us to move far away from the democracy. So that's why I think this is a transition, and also the critical that we have to build international and regional solidarity together.
Yeah, thank you so much, Darika. I do feel like, you know, building bridges and building connections, building this solidarity network among Southeast Asian countries, but also working at the same time to raise international pressures and international awareness in the various ways that activists on the ground in these various countries can will be very important. As you mentioned, it is a very critical juncture for Thailand, but also a lot of other things are happening in Southeast Asia. So, I guess it's been very valuable. It's been a very valuable conversation. So thank you very much for the conversation.
Thank you for having me here.
And that wraps up our discussion with Darika Bamrungchok. Building regional solidarity is crucial, but movements can only go so far without the awareness of digital security to ensure their resilience. Find out more about Security Matters on their website, securitymatters.asia. If your movement is in need of security support, or if you'd like to build regional collaboration, you can reach out to them via their contact page. If issues of digital security concerns you, and you'd like to start a digital security helpline in your country, Digital Defenders Partnership, or DDP, and CiviCert has established a guideline called TechCare, a step-by-step guide to providing digital support for civil society, which you can access at techcare.cc. That's tech-care.cc. To follow the news on what's happening in Thailand, visit prachataienglish.com. That's prachataienglish.com. Or the website for Thai lawyers and human rights at thr2014.com, available in both Thai and English. That's thr2014.com. My name is Bonibel Rambatan, and this has been Southeast Asia Dispatches, brought to you by New Narrative and produced by Dania Udo. I'll see you around.